Introduce yourself, please.
Hi, my name is Lauren Arthur. I am the state representative for Missouri House District 18, which encompasses North Kansas City and the surrounding areas in Kansas City North.
Excellent. Let's get started.
This is State House Blend. I'm Sam Zeh.
And I'm Brian Ellison. We're using coffee
and donuts
to better understand the legislatures on both sides of the state line,
the issues and the people in Topeka
and Jeff City. Here we go. And welcome to State House Blend. I'm Brian Ellison. It's back-to-back Missouri weeks here on the show. This opportunity we have every week to get to know the people and the culture and how the sausage gets made and what the sausage is in Jefferson City. Representative Lauren Arthur is here. The coffee's here. The donuts are here. And we have a couple of our other guests at the table. Our citizen this week is Mark Conneroe from North Kansas City, a former city council member. Mark, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
I'm glad you're here. And also KCUR's Laura Ziegler, who, among other things, has been reporting beyond our borders up in the Northland.
Welcome. Spending a lot of time in the Northland, enjoying it. Thanks, Brian.
Well, we're glad you're here. It's good to have you. So as a listener to the show, Lauren, you know that we always begin by asking you to tell us about your kids, which I understand are of the furry variety.
Yeah, I have a Boston Terrier named Odie, and he loves naps and treats, so we have a lot in common.
Excellent.
And then I'd be remiss if I didn't mention Odie's other owner, and that is my fiancé, Russell.
Yeah, we never really ask about fiancés, spouses, partners. It's just the kids and pets.
Yeah, well, and Odie, to be fair, Odie was around before I was, so I thought I would have to give him a shout-out, too.
That seems fair.
And step pet, that's interesting.
Different dogs come into our lives at different times. It's fine. So how did you get involved in politics?
I feel like I've been asked that question a lot lately, but usually it's said with a healthy amount of skepticism, and the subtext is more like, what in the world were you thinking when you got involved in politics? I've always been a big believer in public service. So I interned at the Smithsonian. After college graduation, I returned to Kansas City and taught middle school in the urban core. It's just something that is really important to me. When the seat opened in 2014, family friends who had served in that position before encouraged me to run. And it seems like a great opportunity to give back to my community because it's where I grew up, hopefully make improvements to that community. And as a young woman, I saw that I could offer a unique perspective because right now the legislature is made up of about 20%, 25% women. And I think it's fair to say that I am the only representative in her 20s. So
wow.
I hope I didn't get that wrong. But
there are men who are representatives in their 20s, but you're the only woman.
That's right. Yeah.
Wow. We have lots to talk about. You and your I want to hear about what it's like to be a first-term legislator at such an interesting time. We'll talk about ethics in Missouri government. You're on the Ethics Committee. Mm-hmm. Lots to talk about, but we always want to start by going around the table and finding what's on the mind of our citizen guest and my colleague journalist. So let's start with you, Mark Conneroe. What's on your mind?
Well, it's a pleasure to be here. And Lauren, it's really a great pleasure to meet you. I know that when I was serving on the city council, your name had come up as a candidate for our area. And you're following in some pretty good footsteps, Trent Skaggs and other folks who have served the position. So I guess a question I have for you is right now we have such a really exciting time happening downtown. And I can remember, 10, 15 years ago when downtown was just a ghost town. It's revitalizing. And now a little bit of that starting to spread across the river into North Kansas City.
Mm-hmm.
How can the state help us kind of bridge that gap, that Burlington, you know, bridge right there is a key artery to bringing people across. How can we help them? Maybe even things like a streetcar line or something. You know?
Sounds like Mark has an answer to that question. What's yours, Laura?
I would actually agree with that. I think we need the streetcar has the ability to become light rail, and we need a light rail up north. I know people who use public transportation to travel from the Northland to downtown. It's not exactly the easiest or most convenient way. I guarantee if we had better public transportation like a light rail, more people would use it. Beyond that, it serves as an incredible tool for economic development. So if the light rail traveled from downtown up Burlington past North Oak, you would see just a boon in economic development along the rail. I think downtown, they've seen like $1 billion in additional investment, $400 million of which is attributable directly to the streetcar. And there is so much potential in my district, in our district, that something like the light rail would just set fire to it.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Laura Ziegler, what's on your mind this morning?
Well, as Lauren mentioned, and we've been talking about, we've been doing this exploration of communities around the metro according to Lines That Unite and Divide Us. In our latest exploration, we've been spending time in communities on and around the Missouri River. Mm-hmm. I was surprised to learn that more than half of Kansas City, Missouri is actually located north of the river. What we heard from communities there is that they feel sometimes neglected and ignored by downtown Kansas City, Missouri city government. I guess my question would be, what do we do about that? How do we make them feel more part of the metro, more part of the city?
Yeah, it's an issue that I heard time and time again on the doors, speaking with voters. And as a lifelong Northlander, it's a feeling to which I can relate. I would like to mention first, though, that in that void, incredible local groups and organizations and leaders in the community have stepped up. So things like Northland Neighborhoods, Inc. I just read an article, and I actually had been in contact with someone who wanted to see sidewalks put in so his kids could walk to school, which is just the most common sense thing. So people are advocates for their area, and I want to applaud their efforts, but I also want to say we shouldn't rely solely on the ingenuity of people in the Northland, and it really should be a city concern as well. How the city decides to spend its money and where it decides to spend its money is really a city council issue. I have shared and will continue to share my opinions and champion Northland issues to make sure that city councilors are really aware of the need up north. Mm-hmm. If given the opportunity to secure state funds for projects that are worthwhile in the Northland, I will fight tooth and nail to make sure that money is brought up north.
How much ability do you feel like you have to do that as a state legislator? Are these issues that the legislature really gets into much, or is this more county and Mark and city government?
Right. Well, it's been my experience this year that when the state wants to interfere in city issues, that it can become quite problematic. So I really believe in our local leaders. I have good relationships with them. I want to be an ally and make sure that I'm doing my part on the state level. But in terms of actually instructing or mandating certain things, that's not something that I'm certainly comfortable with.
Where does the state interfere and where can they be of help?
So I think right now the biggest issue on people's minds is the minimum wage issue. And recently, or before we left session, we voted to pass a bill that would prevent municipalities from raising the minimum wage.
Right.
They also banned the ban on plastic bags. And so when we return to veto session here in a couple of weeks, it's a bill we'll take up again and discuss.
I want to talk about the veto session that's coming up here in a couple of weeks. Mm-hmm. This is the big fall news in the Missouri General Assembly is when legislators come back to town with the chance to override the governor's vetoes. And the biggest hot button issue is the right to work, so-called right to work legislation. 18 Republican representatives and a couple of senators would have to change their votes if the governor's veto is going to be overridden. Advocates on both sides have been running ads all over the state. Mm-hmm. Here's a couple of those.
CEOs make 360 times the average worker. Now a right-to-work bill would allow out-of-state corporations to slash wages and criminalize Missouri small businesses who have union workers.
Right-to-work is a government overreach. I shouldn't be told that I can't have a unionized workforce.
Government should help small businesses create jobs, not run them.
We don't need legislatures telling us how to run our businesses.
Call your legislator. Tell them to stand up for working families and stop government overreach.
K Can Missouri survive another decade without growth? No. Missouri workers need more freedom, more choices, and most importantly, more high-paying jobs. Missouri workers need right to work. 3.6 million new jobs were created in right to work states. Let's bring those new jobs to Missouri. On September 16th, legislators can reject Governor Nixon's veto of this bill. Call your elected officials today and tell them right to work is right for Missouri.
Now, you might not know it from actually listening to the ads. One of those is for and one of those is against. The first one is from Preserve Middle Class America, a labor group. The second one was from the Koch brothers group, Americans for Prosperity. Mm-hmm. The Republican leadership has not said yet whether they're going to try to override governor's veto. It probably depends on whether they have the votes or not. Lauren, you voted against it in the first place. I assume you think the governor's veto should be upheld. Do you think it will be?
I think it absolutely will be, again, if it's brought up for a vote. And I think that's the big issue that people have been discussing this week and last week, whether or not they have the votes. They certainly don't at this point, and I'm confident to say that. But I'm not sure whether or not they'll decide to bring it up.
Why did you vote against this? I mean, you and actually quite a few Republicans. It's a veto-proof majority if the Republicans had been united on this, but a lot of them are bucking the national conservative trend on right-to-work legislation. Why is that?
The call to action with the different ads that have been running has been effective, and I've gotten a lot of phone calls from people in my district. They feel very strongly to vote or to uphold the veto. I have a lot of labor families in my district who have seen the benefits of that. And you know, I think in Missouri we have something like 8% of our workforce is unionized. People who are for right to work argue that workers don't really have a choice in whether or not they're going to work for a union or not. Well, they have a choice. And that's whether or not to go to a union shop or to work for someone else. So that choice exists. And as the ad sort of dramatically suggested, I do see this as a government overreach.
Mm-hmm. Mark, I saw you nodding your head. Well, Lauren, who is a Democrat, we should mention. She's not part of that Republican caucus. But on this point, some of the Republicans agree with her. What did you think?
Well, I think, you know, one of the key things you were talking about, who was sponsoring the ads earlier, Prosperity for the Middle Class. I'm not sure if that was the name of the organization. But the concept of middle class decline certainly runs pretty strong and true. And it seems like this vote, if it was overridden, the veto overridden, I don't see how that's going to help the middle class at all. I'm agreeing.
Laura Ziegler?
Well, I was just going to say it sort of speaks to the border war, and obviously mm-hmm. Kansas, a longtime right-to-work state, and this debate in Missouri. What are your thoughts, and what kind of conversation do you anticipate in Jefferson City in terms of that impact of jobs migrating across state line?
Yeah, I mean, just to add on to that, mm-hmm. Missouri is getting to be surrounded by right-to-work states, Iowa and Kansas and Arkansas and Oklahoma. They all have this legislation.
Right. Well, and I think you can look at those states and see whether jobs have been created or wages have improved, and you can say pretty conclusively that that's not the case. There are plenty of people who choose to set up shop in Missouri because they know that we have skilled workers, and that can be attributed to the fact that we have union membership and a strong union presence here in Missouri.
Also on the agenda of the veto override session is the bill that would remove immigrants who are undocumented and arrived in the country as children from eligibility to receive the state's A-plus scholarship mm-hmm. funds. It passed with numbers that were very close to the two-thirds needed to override the governor's veto. You're on the Higher Education Committee and also the Elementary and Secondary Education Committee. You told the Star that students shouldn't be punished if the issue is simply a funding shortfall. What do you think is going to happen with that, and what should happen, and why?
The bottom line is that this bill makes it more difficult for qualified, ambitious students to afford college. And no matter the circumstances, that's policy that doesn't make a lot of sense to me, especially at a time when we have a legislature that's telling folks to pull themselves up by their bootstraps and at a time when employers from other states, one of their main interests in moving to a different state is whether or not there's a qualified workforce ready for them. Something to mention about these students is that they are here legally. They were granted lawfully present status. And in order to achieve that, they had to subject themselves to scrutiny. They have clean records. And if they're qualified for A+, that also means that they've done community service, that they have made good grades, and that obviously they've earned a position at a higher education institution. It doesn't make a lot of sense to me. It seems like not only is it bad policy, it's a bill that seems to single out a small group of students and punish them. And one more thing, DACA students, they were brought here as children. And most children don't have a lot of ability or influence in decision-making in their families. So to say that they've done something wrong and they should be punished, that mischaracterizes the situation to me.
So help us understand the culture of Jeff City around an issue like this. You're saying these things as though they should be obvious to anyone. Students pulling themselves up by their bootstraps. Nearly two-thirds of the legislature has obviously seen it differently. How does that happen?
That's true. The reason that this budget shortfall exists for funding A+, who's at fault? Basically, the legislature has found an easy scapegoat. And taking away funds from those students doesn't make A+ so much better funded that we can continue the program without looking at other means in the future. What it's done is created a short-term solution. The benefit is that the legislature hasn't really had to look at itself and think about why is this program not fully funded.
It also taps into that broader national sentiment, I think, about who's a legitimate citizen in the United States and what sort of services and expenses should we be putting into that population.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I do think that the legislature saw this as a way to address the immigration problem that so many people talk about at a national level, and they can go back to their constituents and say, we did something about it.
Mark Conroe, I heard you talking with Lauren before we went to the microphones and talking about when she was running for office and she left literature at your door. what are you looking for in a state legislator? Is it agreement with all of the policy issues that are important to you, or is it something else?
I think, first and foremost, it's an advocate for policies and programs in our general area, obviously. The other thing I'm looking for is somebody who can fit into, especially right now, Missouri being so heavily laden toward the Republican side of things, fiscally conservative. How do we continue the programs that help those folks who are most desperately in need of the support, the folks that don't have a voice? The mentally challenged, gosh, who's out there advocating for their benefits not being cut again? MoDOT, who's out there saying, hey, everybody rides on these roads, but yet we're underfunded. So Lauren, I think, presents that balance of going in there. Obviously, there's got to be some compromise. It's a tough road. But there are some basic fundamental things that are a function of state government that we're not funding. And that's a little bit scary. So it needs to be somebody who can go out there and just kind of make sure those basic services continue to be provided by the state.
I do want to ask you about some of your impressions as a first-year legislator, Lauren. I think we have this idea of sort of the gristled old legislators who've been around the state house for decades, and they know how it all works. And you've had to kind of pick all that up in the first year. You co-sponsored a handful of bills. None of them came to the floor for a vote. What's that like? I mean, you're also a Democrat, so you're outvoted on all of the issues.
Yeah. So, well, as you mentioned, I am a young female in the super minority. So I will let you draw your own conclusions about how much power and influence I can wield.
Wait, can I interrupt?
Yeah.
You've mentioned now twice being a young female.
Yeah.
Is that Are you having a different experience because you're A, young, and B, a female, than if you were an older man in his first term?
Well, I have to say that in this context of this conversation, we have to say what's been going on in Jefferson City can't be ignored in terms of the people who've had trouble, shall we say, these old grizzled men, or maybe less old and less grizzled.
A bit of fallout from behaviors unbecoming.
Yeah, I mean, I think maybe the broader question is, what's the culture like, if it's any different for for a young female in Jefferson City than it might be elsewhere?
Yeah. And we've talked about on this podcast about sort of the I mean, Steve Kraske was here last week, who wrote some of those stories in The Star that exposed the intern scandals. You're not an intern. You're there as a state representative, but is it different as a younger woman?
There is a lot to that question.
Yes, we've all added to the question.
I would say it is the lens through which I have experienced being in Jefferson City. Going down the first week, I cannot tell you how many times I was confused for a wife or a daughter, an intern, or an assistant, and it took a while for people to realize that I am actually the state representative. Because I'm in that position, I would say my experience is a little bit different. The power dynamic is a little bit different. I haven't encountered much overt sexism, though I know that happens. My experience deals more with attitudes towards young women generally. So all of those messages we receive in society about young women being meek or not strong, not opinionated, I've had to overcome that barrier with different people's attitudes. As you mentioned, I'm in the super minority. So that means that the Republican Party right now has enough members that they can write and pass whatever legislation they want to. They can override the governor's veto if it comes to that. And they might argue more members, more problems. But really, whatever they want to do, they can control. It doesn't make for great governance. It doesn't make for a lot of moderation or compromise. My focus has always been on constituent services. And when I went down to Jefferson City, I said the one thing I want to do really well is serve the people who sent me here and people who didn't even send me here. I want to serve them too. And so I think we've done a good job of being really responsive to the needs of the community. And I've had the great opportunity to meet a lot of folks from the area and help them address their problems.
You know, Claire McCaskill recently commented about her time at the legislature when she was starting off her political career. Can you contrast and compare to hers? And is it better?
They're
all challenging, I'm sure.
Yeah, it's different. I also focused on building relationships with people on both sides of the aisle. And I do have friendships with people in all corners of the building. And I studied procedure and process, and I'm hoping to use that to my advantage. So I don't think that I'll have my name on a lot of legislation, but that doesn't mean that I'm not working with people to make sure that it's good policy or that the bad bills are any less bad. It's just a difference in my name probably won't be on it, and that's okay with me.
There you go.
Yeah.
Push forward the good stuff.
Yeah.
One thing you did do in your first term is manage to score a seat on the Ethics Committee in the State House of Representatives. Mm-hmm. Quite a year for that, with lots going on ethically, with members resigning over various issues. But also questions, as there have been for many years now, about campaign contributions and gift reporting. And we've asked almost every guest who sat in that chair on this show about this, and they all say something needs to change. Everyone seems to agree, mm-hmm. Republican, Democrat, long-term, first year, but nothing ever does. Why do you think that is? And do you see yourself being able to do anything about that?
I hate to say it, but I am a little cynical. We had an ethics bill come through. It was okay. it was pretty weak. But it was something, and even that couldn't pass. Mm. When it came to the floor, there were probably 10 Democrats with amendments to add that would have strengthened the bill. Everything ranging from campaign contribution limits to I had an amendment that would have dealt with 501c4s, so making sure that if the people for unicorns and fluffy animals run a really nasty campaign ad, there is transparency and accountability in who
put up the money for it.
Yeah, exactly.
Would have revealed more of the donors. Right.
Exactly. So there were a lot of good ideas floated. Not one Democrat was called on during the debate, so we couldn't even offer our amendments. And I hope with new leadership that there will be more of a discussion, more of a compromise for ethics bills. But, you know, the ethics committee, we met one time, and it was at the beginning of the year to establish rules for the committee. So I think that would surprise a lot of people to know that.
Only one time?
Yeah. That doesn't feel like good governance.
The ethics committee in this year in the Missouri legislature did only met one time.
Wow.
Yes. And the ethics committee is a little different in that you have to have an ethics complaint filed in order for that issue to come before the committee.
So it's only there in sort of a quasi-judicial
exactly.
role. It's not there to actually set policies that would make for a more ethical General Assembly.
Exactly. I think there are probably plenty of reasons for there to be complaints to come before the ethics committee, but really none were filed.
Very interesting. Let's go around the table one more time and allow our guests to say a word or ask a question of Laura and Arthur. Mark Conneroe of North Kansas City.
Oh, again, it's great to be here and to meet you in person and to dialogue with you. I brought up the MoDOT issue. Where do you see that one going? Because I'm about to drive a few hundred miles across Missouri and would like my trip to be very smooth.
As someone who drives 70 every week, I agree with that. It is a campaign year coming up, and this year there were a couple of proposals. Initially, it was to raise the gas tax by 2 cents for 3 years, and then it was reduced down to raising the gas tax by 2 cents. And obviously, we have nothing to show for that. Mm-hmm. So in terms of getting something done, again, I hate to be skeptical because I am an eternal optimist, but in that election year, I don't think anyone is interested in raising taxes.
And see, that saddens me because I think MoDOT would play a role in getting across that bridge from downtown into the Northland.
Well, and I had the opportunity to go on a site visit when they were inspecting the Broadway Bridge. And as a Northlander, I thought how important it is that this bridge remain open and it's outdated. I mean, as it exists, it's outdated. We can maintain it for only so long, and without it, our economy is really at risk.
Did it make you nervous to drive across the Broadway Bridge?
I didn't really appreciate looking at the different rest spots, but I know we have great engineers with MoDOT, and safety is their number one priority.
And Laura Ziegler of KCUR.
Well, just to pick up on the ethics question, I guess I'm wondering what your thoughts are on how to create better governance in Jefferson City. And I think it spills back to how to get voters engaged mm-hmm. and caring, either to, change the people that they send or to get involved and have some influence over the political discourse.
Mm-hmm. One of my concerns, while I'm grateful that the issues have been so well documented, one of my concerns is that it's going to discourage normal, intelligent people from running because they don't want to be involved in that process. I think also you'll see people who are frustrated coming out of the woodwork to become a part of the issue and to help solve it.
How much does the culture in Jefferson City have an impact on how engaged people want to be, either running or voting?
Right. Well, I think it definitely discourages people and kind of turns them off. We don't have the same issue, like I said, on the state level of it being so bipartisan that we can't get anything done, which you see on the federal level. But the overall culture, it frustrates me because I know that there are a lot of people down in Jefferson City who are doing the right thing, working really hard and trying to make good changes for the state. But we all kind of get lumped into that category of a bunch of crooks, which isn't accurate. But we have been in the press, and rightfully so, for the wrong reasons. In terms of ethics, there are opportunities to put things on the ballot and to add it to our Constitution. There were campaign contribution limits for a long time until the legislature decided to do away with that. And so if it becomes a part of our Constitution, it can't be done away with.
I want to thank our guests for joining us today. Mark Conaro, sitting in our citizen chair. Thanks for being here.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you.
And KCUR's Laura Ziegler. Always good to have you.
Thank you.
Before we go, Lauren, in an effort to get to know you just a little bit better, we always close the show with your favorite song. What is it?
This question has kept me up nights.
I know,
trying to think of a good answer.
We're developing a bit of a reputation for causing legislators problems.
And it could shape your future politically,
right,
so
yeah.
Keep that in mind.
Well, then I would go with a non-controversial choice, and that is Here Comes the Sun by the Beatles.
Oh.
It's a simple, nice little song. I think it's optimistic. Like I said, I think of myself as optimistic. And it just puts me in a good mood to hear it.
Well, I think it will put us all in a good mood.
Can't go wrong with the Beatles.
Absolutely. Representative Lauren Arthur, Democrat from Kansas City North, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Statehouse Blend is produced by Matt Hodapp. You can find us on iTunes or on kcur.org/statehouseblend. If you use Twitter, that is a great way to keep track of this show and also of all the news from Jeff City and Topeka, too. You can follow me. I'm at PTS Brian. You can also follow my co-host, Sam Zeff. He's at Sam Zeff. We try to use the hashtag StateHouseBlend. You can find a small dose of us on the air every Tuesday morning as part of Up to Date. That's at 11 a.m. on KCUR. And finally, we really want you to come sit in that citizen chair where Mark's sitting now. Help us get to know elected leaders in Missouri and Kansas. And if that's something you want to do, shoot me an email, brian@kcur.org. I'm Brian Ellison. We'll see you next time.